So I guess we can get started. Do you prefer Dr. Reichert or James or Jim?
Jim is fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here,
yeah,
Jim.
Yeah, no worries, man.
I was doing my prep last night, and normally the first place I go to find a little bit of information on the people I'm interviewing is, especially if they're from USASC, is their biography, and your website doesn't have anything about you.
I'm a very mysterious guy.
Yes, you are.
You're not going to find too much on me.
No.
So in terms of my biography, I guess, from Saskatoon, I did everything here at USASC.
Okay.
So undergrad, graduate school, everything done here. And then I went to the University of Manitoba after my PhD, and I did a lot of work in Manitoba. And so I've come back here for this position now.
Mm. I thought too that I did find a little bit. So you're at Manitoba, and you taught at Winnipeg as well.
Yeah.
And a school called, it was
St. Francis Xavier.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of teaching. So that's where I did all my teaching. So I basically came through Winnipeg doing that. And Winnipeg's a good city to do that in. So sessional lecturing, because they've got a couple of major universities. They've got the University of Manitoba, and they've got the University of Winnipeg, which is downtown. And then they got a couple of little satellite universities too, little colleges. So I could get a lot of classes. I could get a lot of experience teaching sessional lecturing. So I managed to teach a lot of classes that way. And then I got a term position out in Nova Scotia for a year. And then I had interviewed for the position at the university, and then they contacted me while I was there. And then, so that's what brought me back here. So I was out there for a year.
Hmm. And were you always kind of planning on circling back into Saskatchewan, or...
Nah, it was just random. Life is random. I just go where it goes. I didn't plan on doing that, no. In fact, it was a strange kind of a thing, because I had applied and I never heard back for a couple months. And I thought, well, that's it for that. And I was out there in Nova Scotia, and I was kind of liking it out there. And then I heard back from here, and I came back and interviewed. So no, nothing is planned in my life. It's a random series of events, like a lot of people, I suppose.
Yeah. That's a good way to keep it, because then you're not, it can get pretty boring if you know what's going to happen to you all the time.
Yeah. Right? Well, it would have been nice to know what I was going to do. I didn't necessarily plan it the way I did it, but it's happened the way it's happened. So I'm kind of glad.
That's good. And so you are a lecturer in psychology.
Right.
And did I get that right? Because when I go on the websites for the schools all the time, I see like lecturer, sessional, professor, assistant professor.
Yeah,
like, there's
no,
so many.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
So in Nova Scotia, I was an assistant professor. So okay. I get the title there. Here, it's a lecturer, and it's officially lecturer without term. So it means that every year I'm staying around. I'm not a sessional. So I don't have to go class by class kind of thing.
Okay.
So it's a more permanent kind of a job. At least I hope it's kind of a permanent job. So it's lecturer without term. So it's a faculty position, essentially, is what it is. But I teach. I'm not required to do any research, and I don't do any research. So I just teach. I just teach a lot of classes.
And you did research a little bit at one point.
I did, yeah. So that was my plan, actually. It's sort of as far as I had a plan. I was doing research. I was getting publications. That was my plan. That was the way to get into academia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I was doing. I was doing that in Saskatchewan, and then I moved to Manitoba, and I was doing that as well there, running like spatial memory studies and things like this. And I was doing some interesting stuff there. But for various reasons, it just didn't keep going. The pandemic didn't help. So that shut everything down.
Yeah, no doubt.
And then once I took the position at St. Francis Xavier, then I was teaching full time there. And so the research, and then once you start getting gaps in the research, it's hard to catch up with that.
Mm.
And so, yeah. So now I'm really a full time teacher, which I don't mind doing. I actually really like teaching.
Yeah, you mentioned that the first time we met, it seems like that's much more in line with what you've kind of found yourself enjoying.
Yeah, I liked it. I always liked it. I always thought I was one of those students who thought, maybe this is kind of like what you're like as well, after talking to you a little bit, is like, you know, you really enjoy certain classes, but I wish they would do this, or I wish they'd do that. I was the guy who's thinking, like, I was very inspired by really good professors and really good teachers. And I thought, the ones that weren't as good, I thought, why don't they just do this? Why don't they just do that? And I thought, if I'm ever that in position, in that position, then I can kind of control the situation
more. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of what I like. That's the part of the job that I really like, is that the entire situation is something that I control within the class, how I'm going to present the material and all of that. So that's the thing that I really liked and still enjoy about
it. Yeah. Do you find that when you were getting into teaching and having these ideas, like I would have preferred if my professors did this or didn't do that. Did you find that once you started, you kind of were like, okay, I know why they were doing that now. And maybe.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You realize how difficult it is.
Yeah.
You're on the spot. And so the first time I taught, I was just trying to survive. So the first time I really taught a class, they were desperate for somebody at the University of Manitoba. There was somebody who bailed on an intro psych class for the summer, and they needed somebody. And I was there. I had a PhD, and I was new people in the department. So I took the job with about 3 weeks of notice.
Wow.
And I didn't think. I thought, well, this is easy. This is intro psych. I'll just go in. But it was 2 hours a day for 6 weeks. And I thought, oh man, I'm in it now. But all of the things you think about that it's going to be like, it changes because you're in front of, 100 students for that summer class. And they're waiting on you to present the material, and you got to have it ready. And you're nervous, so you're talking too fast, because that's the first thing. Everybody talks too fast when they're a first-time teacher. So all of the stuff I wanted to be, I wasn't quite that the first couple times out, because I was just trying to get the material out to them, give them fair exams. That's what students really want. They want to make sure that they're going to be tested fairly and all of that kind of thing. And so my first inclination was, okay, just survive this 6 week class every day. And once I did that, then I realized, okay, well, that worked out okay. I lived. And so then after teaching more and more classes, once you have a class under your belt and you're not under the gun, okay, I got to think of the next material. I got to make it like today for tomorrow kind of thing. Once you've got that, you can settle in. Then it gets easier to like, okay, now I can start to, put more of an interesting spin on some of this stuff. I'll include material that's, they'll find more interesting. It's a little bit outside the box. But you can start to do that. And then that's the part that I like, but it takes time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would imagine too, just like anything else, the more you repeat a particular session of a particular class, the more you know what you're going to teach and where you have time to kind of go on tangents and explore things that you want to talk about that you might have not before, as opposed to other sessions where it's like, no, I need to cram everything into these 2 hours.
So, yes.
Yeah.
You're exactly right. So if you're super prepared, by being super prepared and having done it, that allows you to be flexible. Mm-hmm. So you can go off script. You can just do those things because you have the confidence, and that's what I eventually got with it, I guess.
Yeah. And so it's kind of an off topic, not quite off topic, but we've talked about your lecturing and a little bit of your research, but why psych originally, I guess? I never asked you that.
Oh, psychology was that was the subject that interested me. So that was the thing. That was the one plan that I had that I stuck with. I was actually thinking I was going to go into social psychology when I first got in. But it just didn't take with me. I just didn't, for whatever reason, the social psychology didn't really take. But when I got into a neuroscience class and I saw how the brain worked, that was interesting. Mm. That was the thing that grabbed me. And then it just so happened that the person teaching that class, she was a new faculty member at the U of S at that time. And so she was looking for graduate students, and I became an honor student for her, and then I became a graduate student of hers. And she was more in the neuropsychology end of things. But that was the thing that interested me. So everybody's got their thing, I guess. They find, you know it when you see it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see it, then it's easier to go down that path.
Yeah. Yeah, I've actually been surprised in quite a few of the interviews I've done, especially the other professors have said that they didn't really see themselves in their field.
No.
They're in, which is amazing, because some of the people that are in those positions they're highly decorated and they love it and they're just so excited to talk about it. But it's funny, they laugh when I ask them, they go, I never thought I'd be doing this.
No.
So schedules.
It doesn't shock me at all. Like, so how many people plan their life and know exactly where it's going to go? If you can, you're lucky. I consider that a fortunate thing. But yeah, so many things are just happy accidents, I find.
Mm. And so going into university, did you know that you wanted to take psych by that point, or was it just kind of you started with a psych?
Yes, so I started with psychology. So I went to school first for a year when I was 18, and then that was a disaster. I just didn't want to be here, like leave. So I'd made my first smart decision, which was leave university and go and work and get that experience. And don't be in university if you don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. That's my advice to anybody. And then when I was older, I came back and then I was ready, and it was psychology. So I started with my intro psych, and I knew that that was the direction I was going to go. So psychology was always going to be.
Did you read anything in between there that you kind of like, that made you know when you were coming back the next time that you wanted to be in psych? Or
So while I was working, do you mean?
Yeah, I
was just, there was untapped potential there. Yeah. I was working in jobs that I just felt that I can do better than this. I wasn't, you know, activating my mind enough, and that's what I needed to do. And so, and I always felt that I had potential. Everybody had told me I had potential. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, okay. Yeah. I believe you. But it took a while to kick in.
Mm.
And I was ready for it. I was, you know, I was a little older, and then I was more mature, and I was ready to be here. So I had the study habits. I had the drive to, you know, sit there and really work at it. Yeah. Whereas if you don't have that motivation, it's very hard to do well. So I was ready to do well, and I did, fortunately.
Mm. Yeah. I feel that way about myself a lot too, because I'm out of school now, but sometimes I think it'd be cool to go back now knowing what I do know, and not only just about psych so I can get better grades, but just about, like you said, habits. How do I actually study properly? Set aside your time to do things, because I was relying on just my interests to get me through school, and it can be pretty frustrating sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's—I think if I went back, I would have a much better time because I know how to actually properly study.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, for sure. And I actually see that in my classes with older students. I'm always interested in the older students, the people who are coming back, because they've all got a story. Every one of those people has a story about why they're there. And it's something about some unfulfilled thing that they didn't do in their life.
Yeah.
And so they're coming back to fulfill that. And it's always gratifying to me. Not everybody excels. If they're a little bit older, sometimes they can struggle in university. But it always is gratifying when somebody like that comes back and they really do well. I'm always like happy for them. Okay, this is good, because you're fulfilling something in your life that you know, you missed out before, and now you're getting it.
Yeah. When, like you said, people telling you not, you're not living up to your potential, that can be a pretty good kick in the pants, whether somebody else is, or kick in the butt, whether somebody else is telling you, or whether you just think it yourself. Because if you're sitting there thinking like, I could be doing better than this, it gives you a little bit of that cortisol and that stress to be like, okay, maybe I should be doing something better if I can be.
Yeah. For sure. It's got to come from within. Everything is, you can talk to other people all you want. It'll never work. I mean, they'll, you know, you can get them to enroll in classes.
Yeah.
You can get them to show up maybe, but to really do well and commit themselves, you need that internal kind of motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It sounded like for you, that was that one teacher who became your supervisor. It was kind of,
yep. I needed that. Everything feels like lucky. I mean, I was just a motivated student in the class, and she could see that. And so I ended up working with her. It was an unusual lab to start working in, because she had, she was an animal researcher. So she had birds. So my first research was conducted with birds on the U of S, which I had no prior interest in, but this is my way in. This is what I'll do. But you need that, you know, person that you can kind of follow, and that sort of sets the path for you.
Yeah, can kind of lead the way a little bit.
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
With an interest in neuropsych, did it seem weird, kind of looking at animals first? Like, would you have preferred to be doing research on participants or?
In the end, so the trouble with working with animals is that it's laborious. And so everything takes forever. So the first experiment that I worked on with her. So I was a volunteer in her lab, hmm. and I worked on this experiment with birds, a spatial memory test with birds. And the thing that I quickly learned, well, not necessarily quickly, but it dawned on me after several months, is that these things take forever. Yeah. So these animal studies take forever because you got to show them everything and walk them through every step. So it wouldn't have been my preference to answer your question. It would have, my interest was more with humans, but you know, it's not like the birds weren't interesting. I've written a couple of papers about them. Yeah. So, but human participants is kind of where my interest goes, and it's easier to run studies on people than it is birds.
Or yeah, animals. I imagine. Yeah. Do you keep that kind of mind about yourself going into teaching as well? I would imagine with a research background, it might be a little bit difficult to teach and not trying to be analyzing all the students at the same time.
Analyzing the students?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about that. What a research background gives me is that it gives me that underlying kind of knowledge about how things work, how experiments work and things like this. So I've got that hands-on experience that comes in handy. I'm not just a guy who's telling you about these things. I've done some of this, mm-hmm. right? So that always kind of helps. And students like to know, at least I find, is that they like to know that you've done some of the work as well. So you've got some research, you've got some publications in your background, and things like this. So, I do have some of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, definitely. Like it can be pretty difficult to listen to somebody, not necessarily at school, but like I think everybody's been in a position where they've had a job and somebody's telling them how to do the job differently, and the person telling them how to do it differently is greener than they are.
Yeah.
It's like, leave me alone. Like,
yeah. So. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
So in your classes, do you teach, I think, two different psych courses at the university?
I teach many different psychology courses. Okay. So what I did in what I ended up doing in Winnipeg, just to kind of backtrack, is I started teaching. So I started that first course I told you about, that summer course, was an intro psych course, which was really the first course that I taught. And then I started teaching a bunch of different courses. So I got a lot of teaching, an unusually high amount of teaching, because I was basically making my living as a sessional. So I taught statistics courses and methods courses, neuroanatomy courses, cognitive psychology courses, all kinds of courses. And so those are courses that I taught there, and those are also courses that I teach at the university here. So I teach intro psych. So I've got the big classes of 350 students.
Yeah, wow. Well.
And then I've got the 200 level classes of like brain and behavior kind of type courses and cognitive psychology. I also taught a psychology of language. So I teach all kinds of courses.
Mm. Yeah. Do you have a favorite? Like,
I always like anything with the brain.
Yeah.
Anything with the brain is just second nature to me. I love talking about the brain, and I love making it interesting for students. Cause what I find with the brain is that everybody's interested in it to some degree. Nobody is ever not interested in the brain. But it's very technical information. And so I like to present it in a way that's as interesting as possible to students. So anything with the brain, anything with the nervous system, and then explain it in ways that are not just, you know, learn these terms, learn these structures, tell me what they do kind of thing. Kind of present it in a more interesting way. And that's taken me a long time to be able to do that to a way that's satisfying for me and probably satisfying for the students as well.
Have you found anything that works, like, specifically that you like coming back to in terms of describing the brain? Because I know exactly what you mean. In some of my classes, it's interesting, but it can be very rote, I find, sometimes.
It's always if you relate it to a condition of some kind. Mm-hmm. So the best way to understand what the brain does, what different areas of the brain do, is what happens when they're not doing what they're supposed to, when there's some sort of malfunction or something like this. So people are always interested in the various kinds of problems that arise when there's damage to the brain. So if you describe structures and anything like this, like the hippocampus, okay, well, here's the hippocampus. It allows us to encode, you know, long-term memories. Here's what happens when it's damaged, and we know about amnesiacs, and that that's the way to always interest people. So show them what happens when things go wrong.
Well, yeah, that makes perfect sense. I guess that's kind of like the famous story that everybody knows is about, I think the gentleman's name was Phineas Gage.
Venus Gage, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just using examples like that, kind of.
Yeah, sure. So frontal lobe damage will, you know, cause, you know, this kind of unpredictable behavior. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And so there's always a case study. There's usually going to be a case study somewhere for some of these strange kinds of conditions. And you know, students are always fascinated by that kind of thing.
Yeah. It can be so wild sometimes, especially like when you learn about why somebody's acting a specific way. I found it was eye-opening for me, because not that I know anybody with actual brain trauma, but learning about psych, it really opened my eyes to how different everybody actually can be, just based on mm-hmm. simple changes in their mind or DNA or experiences that they've had. Because at least I went into it thinking like we've all got the same structure, we're all using it the same way, but it's not quite like that.
No, it isn't. And it doesn't even have to be just straight neuroanatomy differences. It's also the way we think and the way we make decisions. Some people make certain decisions one way. They're very quick. Other people have to really draw it out. They're very mm-hmm. careful about all their decision making. So that leans more toward a cognitive psychology end of things. So this is why you kind of asked before, why psychology? Because it encompasses all of these things.
Yeah.
I think it's the most fascinating subject. Like any student who takes psychology, lucky you, because look what everything that's there, mm-hmm. like all of human behavior and animal behavior as well. All of it gets to be encompassed in this subject. So I think it's the most fascinating subject.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. It's my favorite as well. I've been reading a book called The Better Angels of Our Nature by Steven Pinker.
Okay.
It's The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence is Declined. So whenever I tell people I'm reading that book, their question is always declined. They're like, yeah, it's getting better. And so that's a separate conversation in itself. But I'm finally in the last section of this book. It's massive, but he's finally talking about the better angels.
Okay.
And one of the sections that he was talking about was self-control. And he was talking about choosing short-term versus long-term rewards. And experiments that they were doing where they'd put people in an MRI scanner and they would look at the the dorsal lateral cortex and the limbic systems.
Okay.
And see which ones were lighting up more during the choices between two long-term rewards or a long-term and a short-term reward. And it was just blowing my mind, because stuff like that's exactly what we're talking about with decision making. It was fascinating because it was stuff I had a little bit of an idea about, but the part that blew my mind the most was that if the limbic system and the dorsolateral cortex, the prefrontal cortex, were lighting up the same amount, the limbic system would be more powerful.
Oh, okay.
They found if it was the same stimulation,
okay,
the short-term reward would be chosen.
Okay.
Instead of the long, and so they were saying that the prefrontal cortex was looking at the long-term rewards more so than the short-term rewards.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah.
But it was just blowing my mind, because we think about these things as being just always up to us. Our life is always decisions that we're making.
Yeah.
And that we have complete control over. But that opened my eye to the fact that it really depends on what part of your brain is speaking to you.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. There's biological. There's stress hormones in your body. That's going to tell you this is going to tell you to get stressed and things like this. And there's emotional aspects as well. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing with this is how we make decisions, short-term versus long-term rewards. So instant gratification versus, you know, delaying gratification. And they found some of the most interesting research on that when they did it with kids. Years ago, some famous studies were done with kids. Can they delay an instant reward and, you know, wait a little bit for the better reward, you know, down the road a little bit? And they measured kids with that. And then what they found when they followed up with them years down the road, what kind of people did they become? What kind of adults did they become? They found that those were enduring kinds of personality traits. The kids who were quick to like grab the reward and they really, you know, I want the thing right now, as opposed to, you know, being more cautious about it, they found that those people tended to have those kinds of personality traits later on in life. And, you know, the other kids who could delay things a little bit more controlled, you know, things were, they went that route as well as adults. So it's kind of these enduring characteristics of people, and who knows where it comes from. It's your environment, it's your genes, all of it. Everything is mixed together.
I know it's fascinating. It really makes me think to come back to that topic again, just about acknowledging the differences in other people, because it's easy, I think, for everybody to just look at people and think like, why are they doing that way? Or like, why are they like this? And especially perspective taking, people, it's hard for people to see why somebody would look at something differently than they would. But when you have a little bit more knowledge about things like this, especially with those studies that you were talking about that they did on kids and found that these effects or these findings were lasting, it can give you a little bit more of an idea of the fact that maybe somebody is actually just different than you. It's not that they are seeing something wrong. They're seeing it differently. It's proposing, the world's proposing itself to them in a different way.
Yeah, so. For sure. I mean, we've all, like you said, we've all got the same nervous system, but in terms of higher cognitive functioning, everybody's kind of doing their own thing. Mm-hmm. Environmental effects are affecting one person different than another. So I look out at a classroom of students and, you know, they're all getting the same information. I'm saying the same thing to everybody, but everybody's doing something a little bit differently with it. And that's a whole internal idiosyncratic thing. And, you know, the differences are where the interesting things lie, not the similarities, I find.
Yeah, I completely agree. Especially when somebody can open your eyes up to something in a way that you've never looked at it before.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Does that happen often in classes, or have you been teaching long enough now that you've kind of heard it all?
Well, I've heard it all. But I'm actually more open to different, kind of getting back to the teaching thing. What happens is that you kind of get yourself, you want to secure yourself with what you're teaching. Okay, I'm going to teach this topic the way I want to teach it. And it gets sometimes hard to bring in new perspectives, but I'm getting better at that. I'm taking my own advice on that. And so there's certain perspectives that students can give me about certain things that I've actually added into the class because I didn't think about it before. Be a little bit more open-minded about these kinds of things. And I find that students are actually very open-minded about all these different kinds of things.
Yeah. It'd be pretty tough to get through university if you were...
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, because they don't have the older you get, the more set in your ways you get, because, okay, it's like, okay, this is the road I want to go now, but students haven't got that experience yet. So they're an open book. So they're ready to take any kind of path. That's kind of nice about it. This is kind of nice thing about my job as I'm thinking about it, is teaching kids who don't have that cynicism built up. They're really open to all these new experiences. And that's an aspect that I kind of enjoy about this.
Yeah. And so when you're saying that students have mentioned things or brought perspectives that you've added to your courses, is that mostly examples, or is it like actually a different understanding of the topic that you're...
A different understanding. Sometimes they'll ask things. So a question will be asked in a very kind of obvious way. They'll ask a question that I won't necessarily know the answer to, and then I'll look it up, and then if it's interesting to me, I'll add it to the next thing. So you anticipate the next question. So I'm actually incorporating a part of my course now that is changed because I've gotten questions, and because what students are doing when they're asking you questions is they're telling you what's interesting to them. Right. And I didn't have the answer for it, maybe. But this is interesting to you. This will be interesting to more students down the road too. So I'll add this new thing. And you're going to ask me for an example. I don't actually have one.
Yeah, that's okay.
But it's, I find I got to be open. We all got to be open-minded to each other.
Yeah. Well, that's what you'd hope the university is for, right?
Bring
people together to share different ideas and ask questions.
Yeah.
Learn new things.
For sure. It used to be scary when they asked questions. I used to not necessarily encourage questions. I'll just talk. I'll do the talking. You do the listening. And I'll stay on my because I know what I'm going to teach about.
Yeah.
And I wasn't always the most encouraging person about, you know, getting them to ask questions. It used to show up on my evaluations from students. They would say things. I find student evaluations to be just the most eye-opening things because they're very insightful and they've taught me things about myself. They say, you know, he doesn't really ask us questions. They're very nice about it, but he doesn't get us to ask questions or anything like this. So now I do, because I'm more encouraging of them asking questions, because I know that that's a potentially interesting avenue. And it's a tangent that could be a little bit dangerous, right? It'll take us off my path, but I'm more open to those kinds of things now.
Yeah, and it's a good challenge too.
Yeah, for sure.
Did you find that, I guess, were you nervous and kind of hesitant to take questions, do you think, just because you were worried about being able to give the answers on the spot?
Yeah, for sure. Because it's supposed to be in charge. So the next thing about being comfortable with teaching is to say, I don't know what that is. I don't actually know that answer. And that's what students want to hear. If you don't know the answer, don't BS them and try to give them an answer. That's not really right. You always spin things. You do that. You spin a kind of question in a different direction maybe, but if you don't know the answer, just say I don't know the answer on that, but I'll get back to you.
Yeah. Well, I've said this before too, but it's like people that you're teaching, students want you to have the answers, but more than anything they want you to be honest about the answers.
Yes.
Right. So it's even if you don't have it, just like you can tell them that. Like some people do get upset, but most people are gonna be like, okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Students are very straightforward, and I actually kind of knew that. I had that sense even early on when I was teaching. They really just be straight, give us straight information, and test us fairly. Don't give us trick questions or anything like this. And so I've always done that, and so my relationship with students has always been a good one.
Yeah,
with classes, I've always had. We've always gotten along well in a classroom.
That's good. I did go on your Rate My Professor a little bit, and that the students leaving reviews were leaving reviews that speak to that.
Yeah.
You're saying that your exams were fair, and that as long as you went to lectures and you're paying attention, you're going to do well, and that the classes were interesting. And
so. Yeah. One thing that I figured out also early on, I've done, you know, every class I've learned a new thing, because nothing ever works perfect. Mm. So it's like, okay, well, that didn't go great, but okay, what am I going to do next time? And one thing that I realized was that I would present a lot of the information on the slides, and so students didn't necessarily show up. Not everybody needed to show up because they could get the information, and I thought, well, I really want a lot of students in my class. So I designed my classes in a way that you really have to show up to lectures, because I'm going to give you little bits on the slides. I'm going to give you pictures and things, but the really stuff that's going to really count is what I'm going to say. So to get that, you got to show up. And so that's the way I design my classes. So if you're going to be in one of my classes, you got to expect to show up, and then you hear the lectures and you take the notes. And then on my end, on my exams, I'll ask you about things that I said in lecture. Mm-hmm. And so if you attend lecture and you find it interesting, you take good notes, then you'll do well. And so having students show up, I want full rooms. I want students showing up, not feeling that they don't have to show up. So I make the lectures critical to that.
Do you take attendance anyway as well, or is it just by the exams?
Then? Yeah, just by the exams. So if you're going to do well, if you're not going to show up to class, you're not going to do well. You can get notes from other people, but that's a different kind of a thing. I don't know how people. I always found that I had to take my own notes. I was reading somebody else's notes, I don't think it's not the same.
No, it's not. I always felt like. And I know you can, I know students can help themselves out. But I, for whatever reason, I never wanted to ask anybody for notes, because I kind of felt like it was like, if I didn't go, it was like self-punishing.
It's on you.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't at lecture, so I don't get the notes from that lecture. I gotta go to the next one.
I'm like you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have asked anybody. I was a student. I was just my own guy. And I would sit in the room. And I did for myself. I didn't ask notes for anybody, but it's a different world now. Everybody's communicating with everybody in these classes, especially with these online classes. Everybody's out there communicating, saying, I don't know what they're talking about, but they're talking to each other. So there's a lot more communication going on between students than it used to be when I was going.
Do you teach online classes as well?
I do. Yeah. So I've had to record lectures for that. So that was the pandemic, and that was a whole new experience. So I had to, that's a different kind of a thing now. So you have to, because I always want to be interesting. So I think the best way to study for an exam and things like this is if students find the information interesting. So first thing is that for them to find it interesting, I have to find it interesting. So a student told me, I always remember what students tell me. She said, I always know when you're interested in something because you change the way you talk about it. You talk more excited about the things you're interested in. I was like, you notice that? I do. First of all, I do. And then you noticed it. Yeah. And then I thought, okay, I gotta make sure that I'm interested in what I'm teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So going back to the online thing, with the online lectures, I mean, it's like anybody, I'm short attention spans, right? It's me watching a YouTube video of more than 10 minutes is a big accomplishment for me. I don't know about you. But what I had to do with that was I had to really shorten my lectures down, really get to the most important stuff and do it in a short amount of time that I could as part of these recorded lectures. And I had to figure out how to do that on the fly. And like anything, nothing ever works the first time you do it. So with online lectures, what that's taught me to do is really streamline what I need to say, get it said in as short amount of time as possible without losing all the interesting stuff. And the feedback that I get from students from the online classes tends to be pretty good. They find it interesting, and I don't go on too long with them.
So,
yeah.
That's good. I found that in the online classes that I took, that some of them, not all of them, I think it depended more probably on the group of students that I was with, was, excuse me, but I found I got to see a lot of other students' questions more often because they'd be throwing them in the chat as the professor was speaking. And I thought that was cool too, because the same classes that I would have had in person, I was in a lot. The people were just, everybody was shy. Nobody wanted to ask a question. Whereas now here, it's kind of like you're behind a screen, you're a little bit more private, so you can put things in the chat as long as the professor or the lecturer has the chat open during his speaking, I guess, his or her speaking. But yeah, I enjoyed that a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's how students interact with each other online. What I found with online is that I do recorded lectures. So it's me posting recorded lectures. So there's a bit of a distance with that. But what I find is that any amount of personal contact that I do provide, so I'll post my announcements and things like this, anything like that is like worth five times more than it would be in a in-person class. So all of the personal things that you do for an online class is appreciated. It's always appreciated more. It's more like magnified in an online class. And that's something that I'm still working at with these online classes.
And so do you teach online classes that go through like the summer or the fall and winter terms, or is it just summer and spring, or?
It's everything. So in a typical term, I have online classes. So this past term, I had a bunch of students who had my online class. So they were listening to recorded lectures, and then I had an in-person class as well. So I have a mix. The summer tends to be online because students, I don't know, they don't like to come to summer classes. Even though I loved summer classes, I really liked going to summer classes. They were smaller. It was more relaxed vibe in the summertime. I like doing it, but apparently students don't like to.
Maybe they feel like they've owed the campus their time through the winter and the fall, maybe.
You got it. So they like online classes. So online classes really fill up for the summer. So for the summer, I'm teaching a couple classes, but they're going to be online.
Okay. And so when you're pre-recording them all, do you find that like, do you have less going on during the week, or is it still about the same?
Well, when I first started here, so when that was the pandemic, so I started in 2020, and that was the first time using any kind of recording. And that was pandemonium. Like, I was like pressed. Like, I had like three courses and I had to record. And then I didn't realize that the recording was going to take as long as it did. Because I don't know if you've ever done it. You know more about this. But I mean, I screw up things I'm going to say. And yeah. I got to edit it. And I would have like a maybe a 45 minute chunk of a lecture. I would have that is ultimately what would be posted. But there's like 2 hours of nonsense going on there where I'm just, you know, falling over my words. I'm not saying it right. There's something about being in front of a microphone where it's just you in a room and it feels like you're on stage. And yeah, I just mess it up. And I would do multiple takes because I could, because I do multiple takes and then pick the best one and edit it. So it took a lot of time to record them and to edit them. And I was doing that the first year, and that was pretty nuts because I was doing it for a few classes and figuring it out as I go. And plus I have to hear my own voice. So that's always shocking when you do that.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Okay. This is my own voice. Okay. I got to get over that really quickly. And, but basically I've enjoyed the online stuff. It's a whole new thing that I do, but it's a different kind of a discipline for an online class than it is for an in-person. In-person, it's more loose. It's more just going moment to moment. So if I had a preference, it would be for an in-person class. Mm-hmm. It's more of a lively experience. And I get to hear their questions and I get to see their reactions. I get to see if things are working, because you can always tell when it's not working, because students, the minute they're bored, they'll show you that they're bored.
Yeah.
They're going to hit their phones. God forbid they walk out on me or something like this. So anyway, you get the feel for how things are working. And when I can take an intro psych class of 300 plus students and I can keep them in their seats for an hour, 15, hour, 20 minutes, that's not nothing. So, okay, it takes some work to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, from the student side too, I know exactly what you're talking about, because there is, I had a really, really difficult time in school staying awake during classes. And it was probably a combination of things, including bad sleep and too much caffeine at times of day when I shouldn't have had caffeine and so on and so forth. But I had no problem staying asleep in the classes that were the most interesting to me.
Yeah.
And so that's a big part of it too.
Like not sleeping in the interesting ones, right?
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I'm the same way. I used to, nodding off, especially in those afternoon. I didn't nod off in the morning classes. It's those afternoon, like the 3 o'clock time.
Yeah.
When you start to, that's the moment you've had your lunch.
Yeah, exactly.
You're ready to nod off. Yeah. But, for sure.
So do you have, are there a lot of like dialogues in your classes then, or is it mostly just like questions here and there?
So what I teach like an intro psych class is pretty much me talking, and I teach 200 level classes. So I don't teach seminar classes. I've taught them in the past, but I prefer the 200 level classes. So that's kind of the way it is. Okay. We have these topics we're going to go through, and I'm going to do the talking. So there's not a lot of, back and forth, but you know, if they have questions or anything like that, I take those. But I'm not a person to do group projects or anything, because I never liked them as a student. Anything I didn't like as a student, I get to not, okay, I'm going to not do that.
No, I didn't like group projects either. Yeah, that's cool. Oh, I keep losing my thoughts or my questions as they're popping up in my mind. But
well, with a group project, because you end up, somebody else, you do all the work.
Yeah.
And then somebody else takes all the credit. That was the problem. I don't want that to happen to people.
I really didn't like trying to coordinate schedules. I hated trying to like meet people at on campus or at a coffee shop or even on Zoom, like at specific times. I'm like, I want to be doing whatever I want to be doing at that time. Which is not necessarily fair. If you got a group project, if you are given one, you do got to own up and do it. But man, I really didn't like meeting up.
Well, in general, it's the age of the people. They're coming right out of high school early on, and you're not a disciplined person yet, but some people are. And so this is the differences between students that you see. Some have the discipline, they're young and they're ready to do the thing they want to do. And then you see them, some rise and some kind of fall all on their own. And so it takes, it takes a lot, because you come out of high school and you're into university and you're just thrown into a culture shock of, okay, I'm in a big lecture theater and I gotta now we're hearing this, all this stuff, and I'm way back in the seats and I gotta stay awake now. And, you know, some students manage that whole experience a little bit better than others.
Yeah, definitely. When I, like, thankfully, I consider myself quite conscientious now, but I didn't when I was in school. I was just all over the place. And I kept my notes organized and so on. Like, I knew where my classes were, and my binders weren't a giant mess, but my time organizing was just terrible. I would never do things when I was supposed to.
Yeah, so. I see it. Yeah, and especially with that, plays itself out with things like paper assignments. Like, students will, they always think that they've got more time than they do. And, you know, it would be smart to start your paper assignment like a week ahead, as opposed to what they normally do, which is, you know, closer to the day that it's due. And then they don't realize that it's going to take way more time to actually write something carefully and thoughtfully and edit it. Yeah. And so you see the differences between the students in those kinds of tasks.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Because I was like that myself, and everybody knows tons of people that were like that. But you get an assignment for an essay due 6 weeks out, and you're like, I'll do it in the last week. Why?
You need is the cortisol. You mentioned it before. Mm-hmm. So cortisol, it's a fight or flight response, but it's also the response that we have when we've got to be stressed and we've got to deal with something. So it makes you more alert. I don't know about you, but I was actually pretty good at writing papers the day before because I was hyper-focused because of the stress. I had to do this. And so that's a typical human experience. I have to admit that I do it too. Not everybody. You don't just kind of give that up. But the people who can work on it well in advance, you know, more power to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It was not me. And I wouldn't say mine were good, but I was okay getting them done on short notice.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And one thing I do in some of my classes is that for a paper assignment, I'll give them the option of having me read it ahead of time.
Mm.
So I'll give you a pre-read. So if you send this assignment in, you work on it early. So it's the encouragement to work on it early, and then I'll look at it. And then I'll tell you how to fix it. I'll tell you how to get a good mark. But you got to... It encourages them to work on it in advance. And, you know, not every student takes advantage of that. I actually don't get very many of them. But the ones that I do, it's like they're going to end up being quite good because they worked on it ahead and they're not making last-minute decisions on, you know, a paper because it has to be carefully written and edited.
Mm-hmm. I had a few of my professors and lecturers gave me those options too. And I never took advantage of them, mostly because, like, going back to just doing it the night before, I didn't have it done in time to have it proofread by my professors. But I also found that, I'm not encouraging anybody else to have this mentality of a school, but I found myself kind of gauging what I needed to do to be able to get through my degree.
Yeah.
And it was because I wasn't planning on, and I didn't do any postgraduate degrees. And so for me, a lot of the times it was like, okay, well, I know that if I bang this essay out in a couple of days, I'm going to get a 70. And then that's going to get me through this course. And then I'm going to get my degree. And it was kind of like that a lot of the time. I wish I didn't do that going back because I would have learned way more about what I was interested in. But that's what I did.
So. I see it all the time. So the worst thing I hear from a student, and you get this in summer courses, is this is the last course I need. The very worst thing a student can say is this is the last course I need before I graduate. It's not part of their major. They just need this elective.
Right.
I was actually the same way as a student. Now that I remember, I had this course. I just needed this course. I was already in I had my honors project. I was in psychology. All I needed was this elective course in economics. And I just wasn't motivated to be in there. And I all of a sudden I realized that I don't really understand enough to even write a midterm exam. I had to bail out of this class. But what students will do is they'll take a course just for a credit, and they'll do I'm going to give a C effort on this. The weirdest thing to ever witness is a student giving a C effort. Watch a C effort in action, because it's like, well, I just need to know enough to do this, or I need to know enough for that exam to study. I don't need to know a bunch of stuff, so I'll just get a C. And how are you ever going to gauge what's required to get a C? You can't. You're going to end up failing the class. That's what usually happens. So you aim for a C and you get yourself an F and you're struggling for a D. And you'll beg for a D. That's usually what happens with it. So my advice with that is just try your best. Just do your best. Aim for an A. But if you try to aim for like a 70, you're going to get, it's generally not going to work. Did you get your 70 that you aimed for?
I did get a few of them, but no, but you are right. There's, I can't discredit the amount of time. Like there's lots of times where I would think like I'd write something and actually sometimes I would work on it before the due date. Like I actually put some time into it and I'm like, oh, this is awesome. And I had it in and I got a 60. I'm like, shoot, I need to work a little bit harder. But especially with writing, which is so odd because I really, really did not like essays. I liked formulating my thoughts and learning about things that way and kind of trying to create cohesive papers in my mind. I didn't like writing them. I didn't like the formatting a paper and doing the research. And I hated citing things, which is odd because I do that all the time now, just on my own time. It's not for school or anything, but I still write to this day. But yeah, I can't remember where I was going with it. But yeah, I would get lower grades a lot of the time than I expected.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it happens. It happens all the time. But writing papers is a different kind of a discipline. So there's students who can really do really well on exams. Give them an exam and they can really excel. Mm-hmm. Ask them a bunch of multiple choice questions, they can do well. But the separate skill is how to formulate a paper, how to structure a paper, how to write it carefully. It's a separate skill. And so if you want to be a fully, a well-rounded student who's going to go on and succeed, you got to be able to do all those kinds of things. And so the paper writing assignments really kind of allow those students who are good at everything to kind of show themselves. Mm. And it's an ability that in terms of writing paper is just something that sometimes people have to develop. I wasn't great at writing papers when I first started writing them. It's something that requires a lot of practice and a lot of effort.
I found too that helping people with their papers made it more interesting and gave me, and I guess like anything, teaching it can help you learn it a lot better. But I'd help my girlfriend with she's back in school writing some of her essays and papers, and it made me like want to write my own. It was actually really interesting to be like, okay, well, like you gotta fix this because of this. And and then I got positive feedback as well. She said I was good at helping her, which made my interest, piqued my interest more in it. So
yeah, well, that's good. And you're not under the gun to actually get the thing done. And so it gives you that freedom to sort of give, constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can understand that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually, now that you say that too, I think that's probably one of the largest contributing factors for me now is when I'm writing a paper on a thought I have, I'll write a paragraph and then I'll continue it like 2 weeks later. I'll come back to it and then start fleshing it out. But I have that ability now. Whereas in school, you don't. It's got a due date.
Yeah. So. Yeah, there you go. That's another thing. So when you've got a bunch of papers and everything's coming due. So there's this other variable that's not being accounted for with this. It's like a time pressure and a work pressure and, how to manage your time. So it's not just the writing ability, but it's the writing ability and be able to finish this paper and get this other paper done and work on this other project. So students have to juggle all these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So you never really know the writing ability of students is always kind of, well, it's within this context of the pressure of everything in school. It's not always easy to judge writing ability because I never know when I'm reading something, did they write this, last minute? So a very kind way of commenting on that is on a paper is say it seems to be a bit rushed or something like this kind of thing. So I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. You're a good writer, but you just didn't give yourself enough time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems very amicable. Do you find that the students, like, especially in your, do you have paper assignments in your first year classes?
No, I don't have any paper assignments for first year. Too many students for me to...
Yeah, I guess you've got 350.
350 students, and I like to do everything on my own. I actually don't employ TAs for those classes. I just kind of handle the whole thing myself.
Yeah.
So for that kind of a class, just too many students. But other people do. Other people have writing assignments for their 100 level classes.
Okay. And so for the ones that you do, do you find that you're surprised a lot by the quality of the papers in either direction, bad or good? Or is it always kind of around a medium or a mean?
The bad quality ones are sort of not terribly interesting because it's usually somebody did something last minute. That's never interesting. You just waited too long to write your paper. I'm always amazed at some of the really good arguments that are made. When I see a really well-written paper, somebody's really thought it through, that always impresses me. And I'm not afraid to give like really high marks. I'll give it like 100% to a paper like that. So when somebody really organizes their thoughts and they take their time, it's a very pleasurable thing to be able to read that because, you know, they put the effort in. And the really good papers, there's some students who can really write out there, very smart students, and that's always impressive.
Yeah, well, like you said, it's an incredible skill to have to develop. And when a student puts that work in, and then the teacher's excited to read it, it gets a good grade, everybody's happy, and it's really encouraging too. Fortunately, I only had one paper like that, but I really like actually sat down, and it was for a psych class. And I can't remember what the assignment was exactly, but I was trying to put together Vygotsky's zone of proximal development and Piaget's stages of development.
Okay.
I was trying to make them kind of play a game of leapfrog in this paper and show how they were interacting. And I got really interested immediately. And I spent all the time before the due date working on it, and I got a good grade back. And it was just like, it was one of those moments where I'm like, why am I not doing this all the time? Like, that was so much fun.
Yeah, there you go. It's like the old positive reinforcement and all of that. Why don't I do this all the time? But isn't it amazing that you remember those? I had papers like that. Even as an undergrad, I had a couple papers like that that I thought, man, that was a great paper. I still remember it. I got good grade and I got rewarded for it. Somebody didn't just give me some lower grade because I had to hit some average in the class or something like this. You didn't get hit with something like this. You got a legitimate high mark for your paper. And then you remember those. You remember yours. I remember mine. And those are always things that you can carry on later in life. So when you're down and you're not, you know, feeling so great about yourself or you're lacking confidence, I wrote that great paper that time.
Yeah, definitely. It gives you some confidence too. Yeah, that's amazing. And I also, like, I don't know, I might be way out to lunch on this too, but I think that writing is probably the best way to develop your thoughts, and it might be the only one. I don't know, outside, not the only one, sorry. Conversation and writing, I think. I don't think many people are developing their thoughts on their own inside an echo chamber of their head.
Okay.
I think if they're developing their thoughts, it's when they're talking to other people or when they're writing. And so that's why I continue to do it, is just to make sure that if I've got a thought that I want to flesh out, I actually write an essay on it so that I know how I think about it.
Yeah. And then it's got that level of permanence, and the way we interact with the written word is different than we interact with the verbal. Words are lost in time. We just say what we say and they're gone.
Yeah.
But if it's written, there's a sense of permanence to it. And you can go back and you can read it and you can revisit it. Can't really hard to revisit conversations. You just get snippets.
Yeah.
Get a bunch of stuff wrong too when you're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you disagree on, especially if you're having more of a debate with somebody, everybody disagrees on what was actually said. And,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Do you write at all much then with your classes, or just reading?
Not as much writing. So when I did research, I would write, you know, research papers. I did that. And I like that. That's something that I actually miss. I miss organizing, you know, information like that, and then editing it and just reading it and making it all, you know, really work. When you read something, it's gratifying, kind of like what you said. There's something about that. And I miss that. I don't write as much as I used to. I used to when I had to, you know, write up research. So that's something I've kind of gotten away from. Maybe there's some opportunities down the road for me though, if I can pursue those. But it's actually something that I miss doing.
Yeah, when, like we've said this both a couple of times, but it's just so rewarding. Yeah, it just makes you feel really, really good about the stuff that you're trying to work on, thinking about.
Yeah, and you know when you get it right. Like, that's what I wanted. That's perfect. Yeah. I'll read that over again. Let me read that another time.
Yeah.
And I'm probably the only person who's going to read some of this stuff. When you think about, like, a PhD thesis, like, I mean, who's ever going to read that? Yeah. Except for me.
Yeah.
I've read it. My supervisor read it. And, you know, those are words that, you know, they matter the most to the people who are most closely involved, but people aren't generally going to read those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. That's the tough part, right? Especially about research and about everything, really. But, like, most research is not published, and most published research is not read. It's like this hyper minority of people that are producing all of the papers that are read by anybody.
It's right? out there. Yeah. There's a bunch of papers out there. Yeah, for sure. Lots being written. I've got my own. That was one of the frustrating things that I was doing with research, is that I would find my, because you can always see your views of how many people have cited this article, kind of thing. And nobody's, I work so hard on this article and people don't cite it. And then after it gets older, it gets harder, it gets further down the list,
right,
kind of thing. So yeah, that's kind of a frustrating part with research, is that we write up these research papers and very few people read them. At least that was my experience. That's not everybody's experience.
Yeah. I think it is most experience, though, fortunately. And I think that shows itself in most aspects of life. Most things that are produced are not produced by everybody. They're produced by most things that are produced that people see are produced by a very small portion of the population.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Probably that's true. Yeah. And there's some very prolific researchers out there, and they write all the time, and a lot of people read their stuff. And if they're in an influential field, then, you know, you get yourself read. That must be very gratifying.
Mm-hmm. So to go back to papers again and students, is there anybody coming back typically to you a lot that are upset with the grade you gave them? Like, they think that they should have done quite a bit better than they did?
Yeah, you get it. And my policy with this, because I was a little bit older when I went back to school. So I was in school the first time when I was 18, and I spent a year and I wasted my time. And then I came back and I was a little older. So I you know, I had an adult perspective on these things. And so when I wrote a paper and didn't get a proper grade, or if I felt that the grade was just, they're trying to hit a class average or something with this, you know, I wanted to be taken seriously with that. And so if I would argue my point, I wasn't afraid to do that. I wanted to be, you know, taken seriously, and then I could get my grade changed, and it was legitimate. So when students come back to me with that, I actually encourage them to do that. I say, if you feel that there's been an injustice done here and I'm the cause of your injustice, then don't sit with it in your life. Don't let that, you know, you have to come and you owe it to yourself to, you know, argue that point. So I encourage them to do that.
That's good.
And so when they do, and I take an objective look at it, I'm not afraid to do that. Most of the time I'm probably right. I was very careful with the way I graded it. It always helps when I grade the paper, so I know that I'm the one who graded it. Okay, and so I can explain why I gave it. But it has happened where students come back to me and I've read this paper and I thought, well, okay, well, it's probably a fair grade. And I realized I missed the boat. I missed the boat. Yeah, I gave you a 65 and you needed an 85 for this. And be willing to own up to that and say, it's kind of like the honesty thing. Students just want to be treated fairly. And so if I find that I've made a mistake, I'll rectify it for him.
You said it doesn't seem to happen often, though. It's usually you're kind of in line with
them. I'm very students don't generally, because I'm quite I know a fair grade. When I say I'm pretty good at judging papers, I just judge a bunch of them this past couple of weeks, so I'm pretty fair with it, and so I know what I'm seeing. And then as long as you tell them, I find that students, they just want to know why they lost marks. Tell me why I lost marks, and then they'll take that. They'll understand that. So everybody wants, you know, just clarification. So the worst thing you can do with a paper is give a low mark and give very few comments. So tell them why they lost marks. Everybody wants to know why they lost marks.
Yeah.
So I find that I don't get a lot of complaints because I'm very careful in the first place about explaining why you lost this mark, why you lost that mark.
Yeah, that's good. To come back to my own experience again, I remember I had an English paper that I didn't do that well on. I think I got like a 60 or 65 on it. But I don't remember being terribly upset. I was upset the second time around because we got it. And we were all given our papers, and mine had good comments on it to say what needed to be changed and what could have been better. And then when I wrote the next one, I worked really hard on it. And it was only like, I think I got like 5 or 10%. A 5 or 10% higher grade, but I really felt like I had hit all the nails on the head. Yep. that I was told to work on. So I was kind of choked. Just like, I feel like I deserve more than that, but I didn't go and talk to the TA that was grading it. And in their defense, I didn't go and make my case at all. But on the second one, I didn't have those. The comments seemed weirder. They didn't seem as descriptive of why the grade I was getting was the grade I was getting. So yeah, it's cool to hear that you're doing that, explaining to the students why something is the way it is.
Yeah, for sure. And even when TAs grade, so I had some TAs grading my papers this year. I graded for one class and then they graded for the other class because it's just too much work for me. I always go over it and I always look at it. And I'm never afraid to just look at it again. And then if this was unfairly graded, you know, I'll give you the credit for it. Mm-hmm. That's all students want. They just treat them fairly. And so, yeah, that's not a problem for me to do that.
Yeah. And consistently too, right? Like they want to know that, they're getting equitable treatment, but that it's they can expect that in the future as well. It's not going to flip flop and be different all the time.
Yeah. It's kind of part of the thing where I said before, like they're not cynical. The thing I like about students is that they're not cynical. You can make them cynical. Yeah. It doesn't take long. Give them some unfair grades and, don't give them a chance to fight them.
Mm-hmm.
That could make them cynical. But yeah, I'm not worried about, you know, just being straightforward with them. It doesn't cost me anything to do that.
Yeah. So you've got paper assignments, and then, you said you don't do group assignments. Is there any other projects that the students work on outside of like quizzes and exams, or is it?
Not generally that I do, but I have to get probably more creative on that end. So I have to be a little more open-minded maybe on that. So get a little bit more creative on some of the different projects that I can get them to do. But generally it's pretty straightforward. These are second year classes, lots of students, too many. If it's a smaller class, then you can get more involved with those kinds of things. Have them give presentations or things like this. In these bigger classes, these second year classes that are 100 minimum and actually usually more than that, you got to be able to give the information in a way that, you know, they're getting the detail from it, but you can't give them all these intricate assignments that have to be graded. It just doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the challenges that I find that I teach an intro psych class. And I never used to be very good at teaching intro psych because I used to talk a little bit over their heads. And I wasn't realizing the level of the students in intro psych. They're just out of high school. These are 18-year-olds mostly.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people going back for their elective and they're a little bit older. But I wasn't terribly effective at teaching intro psych. So I had to work at that to teach them at the level. And the thing about a big class like that, like a 350 student class, which these typical intro psych classes are, is the challenge is to take a big class like that and make it feel like a small class experience for them. Give them a more intimate experience with that. And that's a very challenging kind of thing to do in a big class like that. And I find it, that's something that I have to, that I'm working on more, and I'm getting better at doing that.
Mm.
But in terms of the different assignments, you can do that just by, you know, giving exams, and you can still do that. But don't really change up the assignments or anything that I use for these classes. But it's an area that I can probably improve on.
Well, if people are enjoying it, like I said, you write, my professor is really. I think what did I write down here? So right, my professor is overwhelmingly awesome. Is the grade the four or five options that they give? It's, I think, awesome on both both the classes that I looked at had like, I think it was like over 60% of the responses. So,
well, assuming that we trust, right, my professor.
Yeah, that's
right?
The answer I always get when I bring that up.
It's kind of like reviews. When you go to, I was buying a computer recently. Okay, do I trust these reviews? How many of these inside reviews, like, do I trust this?
Yeah.
Like, they're all, like, really? 4.8 out of 5? That's what this rates? So, you know, take it for what it's worth.
Yeah. I get that answer a lot. Are faculty pretty generally skeptical of Rate My Professor?
Well, it is what it is. But I got to tell you that what I usually find with comments, when I first saw comments on it, they were usually pretty accurate, especially with the weaknesses. I was talking too fast. I was nervous. I was talking too fast. So I find that the comments that students give, fair exams, things like that's probably generally correct. It's very similar to the comments that I get from evaluations from students normally through the university system for submitting comments. So those are generally kinds of, I don't see anything wildly different from what the experience is, but I'm always hyper vigilant of anything negative. I know it ahead of time. I already know it. I know I talk too fast. I know that, you know, this part of the class didn't work or that. So I'm nobody's more critical about myself than me. So I'm my own worst critic. And so when something doesn't work, I usually know it. But I've gotten very insightful comments from students, though. It always surprises me how sensitive they can be about and how aware they are about things. Like I told you about the student who said, I always know you're excited about something because you change the way you talk. Really? You know this. Okay.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Students are very, I find that they're very... they can be very insightful with some of the comments that they give. Even intro psych students, like they're just out of high school, they can have some very smart comments about things. But Rate My Professor, it is what it is. Take it with a grain of salt, I suppose.
I could find, or I could see one of the issues with Rate My Professor being too, that like a lot of times when people are surveyed on something, especially on a scale that's, I've never done a Rate My Professor, but I assume it's probably like a 1 to 5 scale. I think people tend to either just give a 1 or a 5 all the time too. So
yeah, they're motivated. So a student is probably motivated by other. They're probably more motivated on the negative end of things. So if you've made them mad, so if they feel that something is unfair, that's what will motivate a person to go on Rate My Professor, right? I wrote a review on Rate My Professor way back in the day because I had an unfair teacher, that's. Why students are motivated to go on there is probably maybe a little bit more on the negative end of things.
Yeah, that makes sense too.
But it is what it is. It's an anonymous thing out there in the world. I mean, the world is full of them. Take it for what it is. Don't put too much stock in it, I would say.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're exactly right. It is a chat section on the internet. So you got to take that into account.
You got it. It is what it is. Yeah. The world, we're all sophisticated about these things. We know what that all is all about. These are anonymous comments.
Do you, have you ever been like just completely surprised by feedback you've gotten from a student about your class or about you specifically? Or?
In what way?
Like, just like, wow, I did not think I was doing a good job of that at all. Or vice versa. Like, wow, I thought I was doing a good job of that. And you're being pretty critical of it.
I've gotten comments. Some of the most affecting comments that I've gotten are when students are going through something very serious in their life. So I've had that. I've had students contact me. They'll send an email. They won't put a comment somewhere, but they'll send me an email and they say, I'm going through something really terrible in my life. And your class really helped me, like coming to your class and being able to focus on your class and give me purpose. That really helped me. Like, I remember getting that email. I actually started to tear up as I'm reading that, you know, and I thought, oh, wow. Okay. So there's all these little stories. So you got a class of 350 intro psych students and they're all sitting in their seats and they feel like they're anonymous. But they've all got their interpretations and they've all got their issues in life and they've, you know, and everybody's going through something. And when they come through and they illuminate themselves, it's like a little light turning on and just look over here. And that's always, that affects me. Like, that's like, oh, well, that's really great. Mm-hmm. That you know, I've affected you in a positive way. I've never had anybody come back in a negative way and say, you've ruined my life. It's all because of you.
Yeah, this was terrible.
Yeah, I would have gone. School. I could have been so much. Yeah. But it was you who did this. I've never had that. Students are incredibly polite. They're really polite. Mm. You know, very respectful all the time, I find. So never any negative experiences.
Yeah, no, that's good. I know a professor told me that, I really, really wish somebody would have said this to me when I was a student, but they said that you guys are being vulnerable, essentially, when you go up there and you stand on that stage and you're talking to everybody, especially if you've got a lecture of like 200, 300, 400 students, that it's vulnerable to put yourself out there and talk about something that you're interested in, but many of the students sitting there might not be, and they're not going to pay attention. And just to have that live feedback of whether people, like you said, people start going on their phone if they're bored or they walk out. But yeah, he just said that they're being vulnerable going up there. And I wish I would have thought about that more when I was a student, because it would have given me a lot more respect for the teachers that I wasn't necessarily interested in, and not because of anything about them, but it was just the course material or just the time of day, like you said, falling asleep just because it's that time of day. I would have tried a lot harder to give them the respect that they were owed for being my professor or my lecturer.
I felt the same way. I should have said more too. Yeah. I didn't say it because I was too concentrated on myself. I had my day. What was I going to do later? And you don't think, because they're up there and they're on the spot. And you only know what that's like when you do it. First time I taught that class, in the intro psych class, I'm up there and I'm on the spot and just try not to appear too nervous or anything. But, you know, you're on the spot and nobody can appreciate that. And so as a result, I'm very, whenever somebody does something or if I see somebody doing something, I'd like to tell them they did a good job, because I didn't do it enough with teachers. And when students come up to me and they say, thank you for that class, I get that. It happens occasionally with me that students will come up and say, thank you for your class, it's my favorite class, kind of thing. I always remember that, and it always has an effect. I never blow it off. It always means something to me. And they're going out of their way to say that. Mm-hmm. They're walking up, they're deciding to do this, and they're deciding to make the time to tell me that. And that always has an impact on me. And I always am grateful for it. Because, you know, you don't always appreciate these things until later on in life. I was just, you know, I was reading an elementary school teacher that I had. I saw his name. Occasionally this happens now. The older you get, you see people's names in the obituaries. Mm-hmm. And I thought, whatever happened to that teacher? He was a great teacher. And I noticed that he had passed away. And he was an awesome teacher. This is an elementary school teacher. And he could have just sat at the front of the room at his desk and planned the lessons for the day and all that kind of stuff. But he did all this extra stuff. And I remember he had us put on a puppet play. So we actually made the puppet heads out of clay or whatever. We painted faces on them. Uh-huh. And we put material on them to make them into puppets. We had a stage. He had pre-cut wood. It had to be pre-cut wood. And then, but we would hammer the nails. We would construct it. These are kids. These are like 10, 11-year-old kids. We were old enough to do this. And I thought, man, like, that was so original. Why didn't I tell him? I wish I wasn't an 11-year-old kid. Yeah. Just full of myself and didn't have the sensitivity. That I should have come to him and said, thank you for doing this. Because, you know, he didn't have to do this. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of gets back to that. Like, if you appreciate what a teacher's done. If you appreciate their class, then you can go up and tell them that, because don't bank on it that they're hearing it all the time. Don't bank on that. So say those things at the moment, in the moment, because the moment's not gonna stay.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, I believe too that, like, if you enjoy something and you want it to continue, you should want other people to enjoy it as well. And so if, for example, if you enjoy a class and you want it to continue, or you want this teacher to keep teaching, or this class to be around for other people to take, then you should want other people to enjoy it. And one of the best ways to do that is to tell them that you enjoyed it.
Yeah, and for sure.
Going out of your way.
Yeah, and a teacher who enjoys their teaching their class, you can always tell. Mm-hmm. You can tell. The ones who have been doing it for too long, maybe, or they've taught the same class over and over, and it feels rote, feels like they're going through the motions, you can always tell the ones who really enjoy it, because they're just getting so much more out of it, and yeah, they can't stop that from coming through.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to end this then. Unless, is there anything else that we didn't cover that you'd like to, or?
Nah, I don't know. It's your show.
Well, no, I think I learned a lot. I had a really good time talking to you.
So awesome.
Thank you for being here.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nathan.
Of course.